Hi, Slave Is Gone listeners. Breezy here with Jericho to tell you about another podcast we think you'd like called The Slowdown. Each weekday, The Slowdown delivers short episodes that guide you to understand our common journey through poetry.
The Slowdown has had some great hosts, Tracy K. Smith and Ada Limone, who have both been guests on The Slave Is Gone. Ada recently stepped down as host of The Slowdown to become U.S. Poet Laureate. And the new host is the award-winning poet and writer, Major Jackson.
Both Jericho and I have had poems featured on The Slowdown. Last year, Ada read my poem, Against Mastery.
And in 2020, Tracy highlighted my poem, Say Thank You, Say I'm Sorry.
Join Major Jackson for a hand-picked poem and a moment of reflection every weekday.
Produced by APM Studios in partnership with the Poetry Foundation, you can listen to The Slowdown now, wherever you get podcasts.
They shut me up in prose, as when a little girl, they put me in the closet because they liked me still. Still, could themselves have peeped and seen my brain go round, they might as wise have lodged a bird for treason in the pound. Himself has but to will, and easy as a star, look down upon captivity and laugh. No more have I. This is The Slave Is Gone, the show that talks back to Apple TV's Dickinson.
I'm Jericho Brown.
And I'm Brianne Janae, but you can call me Breezy.
We explore what's historically true, what's emotionally true, what works for us,
and what doesn't, in the Apple TV series about Emily Dickinson.
And because we're poets who are fascinated by Dickinson's verse, we always bring it back to the poetry. Hey, Breezy.
Hey, Jericho.
In this episode, we get to see Christmas Eve dinner at the Dickinsons without Daddy Dickinson, but with Louisa May Alcott and Emily's cooking. You ready to sit down and dig in?
That I'm eating anything Emily put on that table, but I am looking forward to some table talk with our special guest poet and essayist and internet crush of mine, Chen.
And with us, as always, to check the facts will be our rogue scholar, Aoife Murray.
So let's recap and unpack it. Dickinson, Season 1, Episode 8, There's a Certain Slant of Light.
It's Christmas Eve at the Dickinsons, but Emily's father, Edward, has to go to Washington, D.C. for several months and is leaving before dinner. Emily doesn't come outside to say goodbye to him, maybe because he hit her at the end of the last episode.
Emily tells her father she might not be there when he gets back. He says to her, "Where would you go?"
Emily's mother, who we learn is also named Emily, is so depressed about her husband leaving that she stays in bed and has the children, Emily, Lavinia, and Austin, prepare Christmas Eve dinner.
Dinner guests arrive. Emily has invited her father's law clerk and her love interest, Ben Newton, to the party and tries to impress him with her cooking. Ben gets into the spirit and flirts a little with Austin.
Louisa May Alcott, author of Little Women, is also on the guest list, and she and Emily take a jog where Louisa May gives her advice on how to cash in as a writer.
Talk about a writer who's all about the hustle.
And then there's Aunt Lavinia.
Two Lavinias, two Emilys. A bit narcissistic, if you ask me.
The elder Lavinia lets everyone know about her recent trip to Spain and how much she's enjoying being a widow.
After dinner, Sue sings a sad song and dedicates it to Emily.
On Christmas morning, Sue tells Austin that she doesn't want to have children because she's afraid she'll die during childbirth like her mother did. Austin says that's fine with him. And then they do something together that sure looks like it might lead to childbirth.
Under the Christmas tree, Emily finds plans for a conservatory her father is building so that she can grow roses year-round.
And what does her sister Lavinia get for Christmas? a magazine. And this episode was really interesting to me in that we find out that Emily Dickinson is named after her mother.
Which is like, my Lord.
It really wore me out, actually. I was like, wait, her name's been Emily this whole time? And I felt like a little bit of a sexist. Maybe I should have wondered what Emily Dickinson's... And I guess she's just been called Mom or Mother.
And Mrs. Dickinson.
Even her husband Santa. Calls her Mrs. Dickinson, right? So we don't know. Yeah. We don't know the whole time we're watching this that her mother's name is Emily. And I think this episode makes that so pointed because it's really an episode about whose example Emily will follow or whose example anyone can follow, I guess, in the middle of the 19th century. Stu is trying to figure that out in this episode, along with Austin. Is it possible for us to be together without having children in the middle of the 19th century? We even get Louisa May Alcott in this episode as another example of how you might want to live your life as a writer, what the possibilities are.
You know, we get Aunt Lavinia too, who is sort of another, like this widow in the middle of, what is she experiencing?
I don't know what she's experiencing, but she just got back from Spain. And she's...
Oh, widow's euphoria versus the like, I'm so alone because my husband is gone for 2 seconds.
It is interesting. I didn't even think about that. It is, it's a way that Emily's mother and Emily's mother's sister, Lavinia, the elder Lavinia, it's a way that they are sort of on opposite ends of the spectrum because the episode does indeed start with Mrs. Dickinson being forlorn about the fact that her husband's leaving, where her sister's having a great time without her husband traveling the world and even meeting a new guy right in front of us, you know?
And she's just like, woe is me, you know? Like, I'm not even going to write to you because I'm so sad. That doesn't sound like love.
Well, she's always been a, she's sort of a stereotype of a type.
Right? Yes, you're right. I'm asking too much.
Well, yeah, it's hard to get a handle on Dickinson's mother, you know. Well, it's also, you know, one of the things that we're very often talking about is how this show is queer. And so I'm glad we have our special guest, Chin, here, because I do think that one of the questions of the show, in particular of this episode, is how do you build a queer life? How do you survive? How do you improvise? How do you make it work for you? Particularly when you're a writer, and particularly when you're a woman, right? How do you make it work for you when everything in the world seems set up against you, you know?
Well, why don't we take this opportunity to bring in our special guest, author, teacher, and editor, Chin Chin.
Chin Chin's debut book of poetry, When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities, was longlisted for the National Book Award and won the Tom Gunn Award.
Chin's latest poetry collection, Your Emergency Contact Has Experienced an Emergency, is just out from Boa Editions.
And his new book of essays, In Cahoots with the Rabbit God, is coming soon from Noemi Press.
Chin, thank you for joining us on The Slave Is Gone. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you for joining us. We really are glad to have you here today, Chin, really.
Yes. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
I must just say, having read out your bio, and being familiar with your work, you are just like the king of titling. are you not?
I do. Have you
taken that crown?
I do enjoy titling. And I do, like, I have a note in my notes app that's just potential titles.
Oh, that's nice.
Poems and other things. Sometimes they become lines in poems instead.
I need you to title my next thing. Chin, can you do that for me?
Right. No pressure. No big deal.
Do you agree with us? What did you think about the episode? Did you feel this sort of pressure to figure out which way Emily wants to go and how she's going to live? I mean, she goes as far as, we know Emily hates the kitchen, and she goes as far as cooking.
Like, the moment, of all the things.
The moment when she's like, oh, maybe I can be a good little housewife. And I'm like, no one believes that, including you, as you're saying it. But right, she was trying to impress that man, Ben, who she has this kind of connection with, but doesn't seem to understand what it really is or knows kind of conventionally how it's supposed to go, right? Sort of courtship in that era. But, you know, keeps thinking maybe it could be something else, right? Like what kind of friendship can exist between a man and a woman during this period? So I found that really interesting. I was mainly, after watching episode 7, after her father slapped her, that big moment, and then she dreams she's in the circus as, you know, a female poet and sort of on display as kind of the ultimate freak in the circus. I was like, oh my God, it's such a relief, actually, that the father's not here. I felt it. And I felt like all the characters were like freer, you know, without him there. And that moment early on in the episode, when he comes back into the house and asks Emily, oh, aren't you going to be sad? Aren't you going to miss me? And she's just like, nope. I love that she answered that way. And later on, the conservatory, like the garden that the father is promising to build. I mean, it's just really funny, first of all, after, so her sister, who was like, oh, all I got was a magazine for Christmas. And then she imagines it. And like for a split second, it's this vision of joy and freedom to be with the flowers and to be happy sort of in her own space. But then a moment later, right, she's like at the door and it's locked. And so there's this implication that it's just another kind of prison. It's just another constraint. She's going to be boxed into this space or just relegated to that kind of space. And the way that the episode kind of ends too, she's talking with her mother. Yeah, definitely weighing all of these options. And whichever way she turns, there's another potential trap.
It feels important that you said each trap there and not each choice. And yet, as much as Ben provides an opportunity for her to imagine and create an alternative type of queer relationship and queer friendship, and to have a type of safety with each other, it feels strange that the show doesn't have her like consider that, you know? She, like, in some way, she gestures towards it by saying, you know, a man and a woman don't have to get married, but she needs that marriage, you know, in order to sort of escape the trap of her father's house. You know, like, I don't know, I just really wanted there to be some sort of world where they could have had a moment where they genuinely considered being each other's beards, you know, and where she knows that, like, it doesn't make sense to me that, like, they don't see him being like, oh, Austin, I love your cravat. This is homosexual behavior. Like, what is this blindness to it that the show is having them perform?
It's also a kind of blindness that's much like the blindness that exists in reality, in that this guy's told everybody that he is married. Ben has said he's married. He's walking around with a ring on. Emily appears, according to Sue, according to her sister Lavinia, to be throwing herself at him. And then she tells them, you know, little by little, or they figure out, oh, he's not married. And nobody has a question about it. Nobody's wondering why the guy would pretend to be, of all things, married. That would scare, like, if one of my friends, if my sister or my friend was dating a guy who was lying about being married.
Yeah.
I think that's very funny. But the episode itself is brought about, it seems to me, because her father says to her, where else are you going to go?
Yeah.
You know, the building of the conservatory, which is also, you know, the the tool of the abuser. He slapped her and so now he's got to bring her a gift but not apologize for slapping her. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So he knows she likes flowers. He gives her this conservatory, but then he also understands that he says himself that those things are prisons for Emily. This is part of what I wanted to ask you about, Chan, and you too, Breezy. You know, when I was growing up, I really was not under, I'm always surprised that I have any contact with my family at all, anybody in my family. I did not think my life would turn out in a way such that people would be talking to me or I would be talking to them. I might not even be talking to my parents right now. I'm not sure. but I somehow have managed to keep consistent relationships with other people in my family, in spite of the fact that I am a queer writer. And I did not know that I would be able to. As a matter of fact, I picked my writing. I chose my writing over my family. When I decided to be a poet, I understood, like Louisa May Alcott said, she says this when they go running, she says very directly, oh, your family will never speak to you again, but you'll make all this money from your books.
$35.
Yeah, I was not expecting $35 for my poems. I was not expecting to make any money from my poems, and yet I was indeed willing to give my family up for them. I did not believe that they would want anything to do with me. And I was okay with that. You know, I kind of was ready to get rid of them too. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I challenge this narrative that like you chose to give up your family so much as you chose to speak your truth and let your family handle that as they would.
That's smart.
You know, and I just feel that if the cost of our relationship is my silence, then that's not a healthy relationship and I probably shouldn't be in it. And it has taken me a minute to learn that for certain. And, you know, like my third book is coming out this year and we gonna see who love me.
right.
But I'll say, you know, like when my second book came out and, you know, like I talk pretty honestly about my relationship with my dad. And he called me and was like, yo, I'm sorry. I didn't even know like stuff affected you like it did. And it was like a real genuine, like honest, like apology and not like a, like, we gotta cry about it. We gotta have, you know, like, it was just like a, let me just make sure I address this.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I don't expect to get that from all my family, but I am grateful that I got it from my dad because it has let me know like what's possible. Let's see where the bar is. And you know, people going to get over there or they going to go under it. I don't know. And that's between them and Jesus. It's not my problem.
What about you, Chan?
Oh my God. I love this question. And what comes to mind is I get asked so often after readings, if I read a bunch of the poems about my parents, especially my relationship with my mother, I'll get all these questions, usually from older white people, usually older white women, who just have a look of concern on their faces as they ask this. And they're always like, are things okay now with your parents? And I just have gotten so annoyed with that question. Because one, I just feel like I don't owe you that answer. Like, why do you feel like you have that kind of access? Yes, the work is personal, but I put what I wanted to put in the book. And you can sit with that. And if it's uncomfortable to sit with, then good. It doesn't have to be resolved. I don't have to do that for you. And even when like the relationship has improved, and it has, especially recently, I just feel like I don't know if I want to necessarily put that in the work or give other people access to it. So that's something I think about a lot, especially with students. When I work with queer students who are writing about family and difficult familial situations, sometimes I really just want to say, like, yeah, you're going to have to choose the work. And it is a risk. And you mm-hmm. should think seriously about that risk
mm-hmm.
and what it involves. Mm-hmm. But are you willing to go there to tell some truths and make some art, right? Do something transformative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you really want to go there, then you have to accept that there might be some consequences. So, you know, they might read this, they might not like it. You might go through a period of them really not liking it, and you might not mm-hmm. talk for a while. You might talk, you might argue about it, or, you know, just go through some space for a mm-hmm. while. So all sorts of things can happen, but I think you might want to be a bit prepared.
I think it's important, you know, the good news, as they say in church, Lord, is, I don't know, I've been grateful for all of the times that someone has gone there, and grateful for all of the moments, especially when we're talking about like family and we're talking about our parents, and we're taught from such a young age, you know, that anything we say that's even just like a whisper of like critique is like ungratefulness, and we're just like the most horrid child. And it is, in some ways, it's lovely to sort of like step out and be like, yeah, I'm another one of those horrid children. You know, there are so many of us.
When you go there, you meet other folks who have been there
mm-hmm.
for a little while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would say that because Chin is bringing it up, the biggest thing, the biggest stumbling block or roadblock, the biggest thing holding my own students up over the years from their poems has to do with this fear of what their parents will think about what they write. Even when my students are not writing about mm-hmm. their parents, they are very concerned about their parents' judgment of them through their poems. And so I think, you know, I spend at least a third of the semester doing things to help us get around that fear about parents. And I think it's very, you know, it's a fear that is justified. I'll say that,
mm-hmm.
right? Because parents really do be out here putting their kids out, not paying what they said mm-hmm. they was gonna pay for all of a sudden, because mm-hmm. you're not living exactly how mm-hmm. I said you should live, right? I also think, you know, if you want to be an artist and if you want to tell the truth, you're going to have to, I always tell my students, if you're going to tell the truth, you can't write poems without telling the truth. And if you're going to tell the truth, you're going to have to be able to go it alone. You have to feel the feeling, even if it's not true. You have to feel like you're the only person telling the truth in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta, you gotta find a way to get proud of that and not scared of it. Thanks to Smith College for its sponsorship of The Slave Is Gone.
Smith first opened its doors to students in 1871, when Emily Dickinson was still living and writing up the road in Amherst.
And just like no one at that time would have imagined that Emily Dickinson's poems would be read around the world, they'd probably also be surprised by the impact this women's college continues to have more than 150 years later.
Smith's faculty, students, and community of alums are driving change in the world, making knowledge a force for good.
Whether you're a parent, a prospective student, an academic professional, or someone who counts yourself as part of the Smith community, learn about Smith now at smith.edu. I'm hoping I can bring in Aoife, our Rogue Scholar, because I do want to ask her about this Christmas dinner and how there was a wonderful array of guests at the Christmas dinner. Is it possible that these people would have actually sat down with the Dickinsons, with Emily Dickinson herself, for dinner at Christmas time? Did Emily Dickinson have literal interaction with Louisa May Alcott? It doesn't seem like she would have.
And like, could Emily actually cook? You know, because
it looks like she's
whole.
It looks like she never cooked before and suddenly made the best meal that anyone has ever made in life.
A whole Christmas feast.
She was a hell of a cook.
Oh, wow.
And she was an amazing baker.
Oh, wow.
The family wanted her food. That's the show. The show created that whole riff so they could set up the whole thing with Ben. I don't know if she met Alcott. There's more likely that she would have met Emerson. Fanny Boltwood. Okay, so the Boltwoods were sort of a peer family to the Dickinsons, kind of same powerful family in the town. And Fanny Boltwood's cousin was Emerson. So Emerson was in and out of Amherst a lot. So there's more of a chance that Dickinson met Emerson than she would have met Alcott. But I don't know. I don't know. You know, Ben was actually such a critical role model for her. He was from Eastern Massachusetts. There was a whole new philosophy emerging out of Concord, right? Transcendentalism. And then Unitarian, right? Unitarianism is sort of taking Europe and America by this idea that you would reject original sin, that people and nature were essentially good, right? I mean, that's what Thoreau was all about. Emerson was all about. But this was like completely not the world Emily was from. Emily was from this really conservative, sort of orthodox world. And so Ben kind of comes in, and that world had no relationship with the Unitarians, with this whole sort of transcendent. I mean, it was just a whole nother world. And Ben comes, sort of crosses that hard divide and introduces her to Emerson. And it's like air blew into her world in terms of what's possible for her as an artist and a thinker and being in the world, that it wasn't just this very narrow, right, that her father and grandfather, Dickinson, sort of ascribed to, that kind of rigidity.
I wonder, though, one other thing Alcott says is, you know, that she's got to stop writing poetry because she's not going to make money there, right? Which is so true today, right? And was that true then?
You know, that's a really good question. Like, what were poets bringing in? I know what journalists were bringing in when they when Alcott brings up Fanny Fern. She was the highest paid U.S. journalist. I mean, like in today's dollars, she was making almost $3 million. But Alcott, she sold the manuscript of Little Women for, like, in today's dollars, $135,000. And she was making in royalties about $2 million a year. So I don't know what poetry.
That's great.
Yeah, but so I don't know. I don't know what poets were making. I mean, because Emerson was writing poetry.
You know, we see Louisa talk so much about the market, right? And thinking about the market and thinking about the ways that she has to write something that will be sold and write something that will make money, right? That's sellable. And in some ways, it's like, yes, Emily did not get to publish her work, but it does feel a little bit like a privilege to be able to write and not have to worry about who is picking up, whether or not your work is being picked up.
Alcott, I mean, her father he lost everything trying to find this utopian community or commune, this sort of transcendentalist commune called Fruitlands. So the family was destitute, and she was able to create story and plot things, and she was brilliant at it. So she did, and she was able to, she starts making $2 million in royalties. Her father could have found as many communes as he wanted to, and she could have funded them. So right. I mean, Dickinson didn't have to, and all of that inherited wealth that came down made it possible. So they did have different drivers.
I love the scene at dinner when Louisa basically comes up with the plot for Moby Dick. And then it's like, no, that's too boring. But just the way that she's thinking about what will sell. Right?
Then she comes up with the plot for Little Women, and everybody else thinks that's boring.
And she's like, oh, wait, what if a sister dies? But just how quickly she like goes through those plots and how much she's thinking about audience. Which feels like maybe one of the main differences, where, you know, the prose writers are thinking about what sells, what kind of audience will there be for this, what's the market for it, and Emily's thinking about, you know, moths and lines and a conservatory possibly.
Did Sue's mother really die in childbirth?
Sue's mother did not die in childbirth. Sue's mother died when she was 4. Her father died when she was 10. She was an Amherst girl, but she went to Geneva, New York, when her father died to be raised by an aunt. But then when she became a teen, she comes back to live with her sister in Amherst. So just want to get that in there, that the show is playing with some things there.
How likely is it that you would be able to tell your betrothed that you don't want to have kids and they would be as okay as Austin is with Sue telling him that she doesn't want to have children?
How would they do that?
Yeah, that was my question. Because I was like, okay, it's one thing to be like, oh, we don't got to have kids, baby.
They could have bundled. You know, that was a way that, you know, so that you could get intimate with somebody, you would bundle. So you'd have clothes, not a clothing, but you'd have this fabric on or like a sheet or a something so that you could pretty much do everything. You don't think so? You don't think they would have done that?
No, I'm just being like, this is yet another instance where I learned something about, against my will, about what people do when they're not supposed to have sex, but they are people and obviously want to have sex.
What's birth control in the 19th century?
Condoms, prolonged breastfeeding, sponges, and withdrawal rhythm, besides bundling.
Eva is very excited about bundling, I want to point out. I'm like afraid to know too much about bundling because I think it's going to happen to me if I find out about it. I don't want to. I have a very strong feeling I want nothing to do with bundling.
Wait a minute.
Go ahead.
You have done something like this, right?
You've been
dressed, have all your clothes on.
Wow.
And you do just about everything, but...
Oh, you know what? We in the Black community, we call that hunching.
Okay. Okay, so this was the 19th century version of it.
Hunching.
Yeah.
I love that bundling. That's beautiful. That sounds so nice.
Yeah.
Bundling.
Like swaddling.
Yeah. It sounds like
swaddling. Exactly. And it's a way to find out if you're compatible with somebody.
Huh.
Without having a consequence.
Oh, that's interesting. That's actually smart. That's interesting. That's something to think about.
Yeah, the physicality, like, and just what they're able to do. I mean, the running was hilarious to me when Emily was running with Louisa.
Oh, wow.
And was like so into it. And I'm like, how many layers are you wearing? And it's like, what's here? And when she leaped over the log, oh my God.
Aoife, she must have been a runner in real life. That would be the only reason they put it in the show.
Yeah.
How many people were running? I mean, is this like the beginning of running or something like that? Like, is this when running becomes something you do to stay fit?
I don't know if it was a movement, but she started when she was about 13 and had almost a, I don't know, religious experience. And she continued to run ever since. And in some way, she felt it kind of strengthened her for writing.
Wow.
Do y'all?
I mean, that makes sense. I certainly love a nice long walk.
Before writing?
Yeah, for writing, you know. I like to say I like wander around with a basket looking for poems. Hopefully something comes.
I mean,
Shin, do you have any physical that you do that you think is connected to your writing?
Not anymore.
You used to?
Oh.
I used to. I was going to say, actually, yeah, when I was younger, like, 13, 14, 15, I did track. I was on the track team and on cross country, so long distance running.
Wow.
Yeah, so like endurance
sports. Did you enjoy that?
I actually did. I really did. Because I wasn't in team sports, you know, it's like projects. I didn't want to have to rely on someone else to do that. And looking back on it, maybe that's kind of related to writing, like the solitude of writing and being with yourself, being with your imagination, and having that kind of self-reliance in a way. Running and writing kind of coincided, which I hadn't thought about it in quite that way before.
There's that moment where Sue sings her sad, sad song for Emily.
Piano, yeah.
At the piano, you know, and she's like, in the bleak midwinter, you know, my boo. Even as she's about to marry Austin, even as she knows Emily's gotta figure out her place in the world too. And I don't know, I just really love that moment. And it makes me think of sort of like, what are your breakup songs? What are your like, I'm so sad, my boo has left me, you know, and you're going up, you're in the karaoke bar, You're a little tipsy, just tipsy enough to get up there. What song are you putting on? What are you singing for the people?
I mean, pretty much anything by Fiona Apple is a go-to.
Yes.
For kind of raw breakup energy.
You got to hit us with a lyric.
Looking it up, sorry.
I was going to say, Jericho, don't think I didn't ask this question to you, too.
This is hilarious.
Aoife, you can
oh wow,
drop your answers. I want to know.
I don't think I can think about this in terms of karaoke, but I will say, certainly. I think the saddest song, there are two songs, I can't figure out which one is the saddest. I know I cry every time I hear Stronger Than Pride by Sade, every time. Even if I'm over somebody, like I don't even have, you know, I don't have anybody right now, but I'm not like pining after anybody either. I sort of like, when I hear that song, I immediately begin to pine after everybody I ever loved. You know what I mean? And then there's this song that's not as well known by Denise Williams called If You Don't Believe, which is one of the saddest things I've ever heard. It's so beautiful. It's a beautiful song. It's a long song too, and I love a good long song. Those songs had me thinking about jumping off buildings. So I would not make that playlist, but if you can handle it, those are some of them.
I love an If You Can Handle It playlist.
Yeah.
I would love a group poet If You Can Handle It playlist, actually. I love a sad playlist.
You know, I spent a good deal of my 20s, you know, so yesterday, thinking about but making making surveys of the saddest songs. So I actually know what they are.
I love listening to breakup songs, actually, just for the energy of them. And yeah, I pulled up one of these Fiona Apple songs. There's one called Left Alone. The chorus goes, how can I ask anyone to love me when all I do is beg to be left? When all I do is beg to be left? When all I do is beg to be left alone? And the way that alone comes in is so good. Beg to be left, right? But then beg to be left alone.
Shin, since you're reading lyrics for us, maybe you can share a poem for us. Will you read us a poem?
Sure. Yes. It's a poem that's thinking about literary lineage. Because actually, I grew up in Amherst. And I've been to Dickinson's house like 4 different times.
Oh, wow.
School trips, and I think a date once, which was kind of funny. So this is called Origin Story. Night falls. Two other poets and I sit on the porch of a farmhouse in Tennessee. We eat 2 kinds of pasta, then gently shoo out 2 cats who like to wander in, often overstay. The one who has written the most this week is the best shooer. I wish poets were named after their superpowers, like the Amazing Volta, or Captain Syllable Count, or Super Self-Doubter. One of the cats, I am told, gets fed at 3 houses. At each, he receives a different name. Simon is his name at the farmhouse, and somehow we agree to follow tradition. We pat him behind his ears and sing Simon. In college, a poetry professor asked, are you from Whitman or from Dickinson? Which sounded like he was asking, are you American? The next night we find Simon sitting atop my bed. He won't budge. For a moment, he seems to look right at me, serious and exasperated, as though we'd come to an agreement weeks ago about trading places, names, selves, and I'm the fool who's forgotten. In one sense, I'm from Dickinson, because I grew up 2 miles from her house. I grew up on afternoon field trips to her house. I close my eyes and I'm standing in her house, the well-practiced tour guide singing, I like to see it lap the miles and lick the valleys up. How fourth grade me thought she was talking about a giant cat. Rain falls. I press my head against a foreign pillow. It's too green. I try to sleep, to let my mind leave me and then re-enter. In the tingly, hairy, gay sense, I'm from Whitman. The refusal of sense, I'm from the cat we agree to call Simon. I'm from his other names. I'm from his future names. I'm from the hunger between his names. I'm from the wet grass he walks through to reach the next house.
Very good. Thank you so much. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. We give gratitude. And now we have a question for the poet from Aoife.
Last time, Jericho was talking about a visual response to Dickinson's work, that when he was young, the dashes were entry points. Mm-hmm. So it was a visual response. In your work, are you driven by the page, right? By the visualness of poetry? Are you driven by sound? Are you driven by something else? What fires the work?
Who knows the answer to that question? This is hard. Usually the question for the poets is not as difficult as this one.
It's a challenge.
I would just like to announce that we were not prepared in any way. I'll say that for me, it's not the image. I think sound is important, but more than sound, it's the fact that sound does this weird thing where it makes things sound true. So you could say something that's completely wrong or doesn't necessarily make sense. Like, look for the purple banana until they throw us in the truck, you know, which sounds pretty crazy, but very true to me. I mean, part of the reason why I've always loved the lyrics to that song is because, you know, or everybody's got a bomb. Do you know what I mean? Like, all of that, something about all of that just sounds like it must be. And I think that's what really drives me. Like, I want to say these things. I keep thinking if I can use the music of language to say things, I will come to the truth about something.
I mean, it's that thing that people say about, like, poems being like witchcraft. But it is, like, as you were saying that, I was like, yeah, that music makes you feel like, I don't know, I trust this. This feels right because it sounds good, and sounding good feels good in my body. And if it feels good in my body, then it must be true. And it's like a whole manifestation.
No one else can make me feel the colors that you bring. So true, right? Like, there's no way around that. No one else can make me feel the colors that you bring is absolute, but I mean, there's no way you can call that sense making. Do you know what I mean? You know what I mean? I mean, it actually defies sense in order to make sense. Chin?
I think for me, it's also sounds. When something just tickles me a bit, or it's like a little off, and not necessarily funny, like haha funny, but it could be something really humorous. But like, for example, I was talking with one of my MFA students earlier, shout out to Greg Mawson, who at one point in the conversation, I forget what the beginning of the sentence was, but at one point he said, oh yeah, I was really into the existentialists. And there's something about really into the existentialists. I just wrote down that phrase. I don't know, maybe it's the contrast between really into and the existential. Or like, I've been working on this poem that's called Growing Up in New England. It's just like playing with something that sounds quite ordinary, but the more that you kind of add to it, it can become stranger and stranger, actually. So I'm drawn to those pieces of language, everyday pieces of language that I like thinking about and making strange.
We do okay, Aoife?
Beautiful and always going places that you never know. It's wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you. And big thanks to Chin Chin for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The Slave Is Gone, where we continue the conversation started by Dickinson and go way beyond.
That's Brianne Janae. Their first book is After Jubilee,
and they're the author of Blessed Are the Peacemakers, which won the Cave Canem Northwestern University Press Poetry Prize.
That's Jericho Brown. His book, The Tradition, won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. His other books include Please and The New Testament.
A big thanks to Chin Chin for being our guest on this episode.
His latest poetry collection, Your Emergency Contact Has Experienced an Emergency, is out now, and his new book of essays, In Cahoots with the Rabbit God, is coming soon.
Our rogue scholar is Aoife Murray, author of Made as Muse, How Servants Changed Emily Dickinson's Life and Language. Aoife and Lisa Rothman are the show's executive producers.
Matt Martin produces the show. Mary Ann Zahorsky and Celia Bolgatz engineer and edit our audio. Marissa Budlong and Anna Smith are our researchers. And our interns are Lola Anaya and Maggie Olszewski.
Dr. Marilyn Nelson and Dr. Terry Bonhorst Blackhawk are our advisors. And the show receives support from Mass Humanities and the Massachusetts Cultural Council.
Thanks to the many individuals who contributed to make this episode possible. You can give your support with a donation at theslaveisgone.com.
And a final thanks to Catherine Whitcomb and everyone at the Jones Library in Amherst, as well as to the Boutel Day Poetry Center at Smith College.
We are on Twitter and Instagram. Follow us for bonus materials that take you deeper into Emily Dickinson's life and art and the world she lived in.
We'll give her the last word.
There's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us. We can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None may teach it any. 'Tis the seal, despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens. Shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death.